Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Aaron Wright, Warren Allen, and Peter von Valkenburg. And if you want to know how the Bitcoin blockchain can fight Ebola, save journalism, enable smart contracts, and yet is under attack, this is not a show to miss. Join us.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 278, recorded October 10th, 2014, Schrodinger's Crypto. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting, wholesome snacks right to your door. Forget the vending machine and start snacking smarter with wholesome, delicious treats like baked cheddar potato sticks. To get your free NatureBox sampler box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. So glad that you're joining us for this episode of This Week in Law, because it's on a topic that I personally don't know enough about. So I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to learn from the really brilliant folks who are joining us today. I'm guessing that maybe you guys out there, I don't know, probably lots of you know more than I do about the specifics and technology, possibly not quite as much about all of the policy ramifications and all of the potential uses of the technology behind Bitcoin. So we're going to go deep on that today, and we've got a great panel of folks to do it. All of this, if you, blame Aaron Wright for this show, because he emailed me and raised a ton of issues that I'd never, ever thought of before and did not know were happening, thought that it would be great synergy for our show. And he was absolutely right about that. Aaron, it's great to have you joining us today. And thank you for lighting the fire under me to put together this show today.
Thanks for having me. I've always been a big fan and I'm really happy to be on.
We're thrilled to have you. For those of you not familiar with Aaron, he is the director of Cardozo Law's tech startup clinic. He was also the co-founder of Armchair GM, which got bought by Wikia, at which point he became general counsel and a VP at Wikia. So Aaron, thrilled to have you. And once again, thanks so much for getting us to go deep on Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
So as soon as Aaron emailed me and we realized we would be going deep on Bitcoin and looking at some current controversial issues about the regulation of Bitcoin, I knew that we had to have Jerry Brito or someone blessed by Jerry Brito. Excuse me. I always do that to his name at least once when I say it. It's Jerry Brito. And he put us in touch with Peter von Valkenburg, who is the director of research for Coin Center. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Denise, and hi, everyone, and thank you for confirming my blessed status from the great Brito.
Yes, you have been blessed by the great Brito.
Jerry's our executive director here at Coin Center, and we're a really fresh organization that's a nonprofit looking out for preserving freedom of action for innovators in the digital currency space. So happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you. And in a stroke of great synergy, Peter is fresh off a gig speaking at the DC Legal Hackers Meetup. And we're going to talk a bit about what Peter discussed there. But guess what? Joining us is the lead director of the New York Legal Hackers organization. And that's Warren Allen. Welcome back, Warren.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having me again. I should correct. I'm not really the lead director. We have four directors, Phil Weiss, Tariq Badat, and Lauren Mack. And I'm just one of the four. But, we all sort of share decision making powers on that and responsibilities. But it's a lot of fun. And, we also have a number of chapters outside New York and the D.C. one. Very proud of too, and they do amazing work with Rick Williams and Jameson Dempsey and Alan Deletti too. So, got to spread the love around for the legal hackers.
And you've been on our show, this is, I don't know, your third or fourth time now, but tell us, for someone who might have missed those previous wonderful sojourns of yours on This Week in Law, what's Legal Hackers all about again?
So Legal Hackers is really, you know, it's a sort of a movement looking at bringing lawyers and coders and technology people together in the same room, having great conversations, you know, like the same kind of things that you do on This Week in Law, talking about how law doesn't keep up with technology and vice versa, and, you know, thinking about sort of practical solutions about what we can do to change that. So, you know, hopefully I think we'll have some good legal hacking basically happening right on the show.
Yeah, let's do it. And we're going to talk a lot about the ramifications and the regulatory framework and immediate future of Bitcoin. So let's go there right now. All right, Aaron, when you emailed me, you let me know that they're in New York, where two of you are. Is that right? No, at least Warren is there.
But I'm in New York too, yeah.
Oh, you're in New York too. There we go.
Yeah.
So there is legislation already pending, or at least regulatory rumblings afoot from the Department of Financial Services in the state about wanting to license people who are involved in the Bitcoin infrastructure. Can you tell us, tee that up for us? What's going on there?
Yeah, sure. So the Department of Financial Services, which is a department in New York State, has proposed a bit license regulation. It's still a proposal. It's a very long regulation. But basically, if you are transmitting virtual currency and it's not really for a gaming purpose, then you are potentially subject to this licensing scheme. And this licensing scheme has some really interesting and potentially difficult implications for startups and other companies that are going to be working in this space. You know, you'd have to get fingerprinted. There's bonding requirements. There's a lot of, you know, pages and pages of requirements of things that you'd have to comply with in order to satisfy this regulatory scheme. You know, the idea, I think what really pushed this forward is that the Department of Financial Services is worried about you know, potentially problematic aspects of virtual currencies in terms of consumer protection, in terms of just making sure that the government has a sufficient handle on tracking where money is going. So there's this rule called the Bank Secrecy Act, and there's a bunch of rules, anti-money laundering rules, and New York State has basically tried to take a slant on those rules and package them up in a proposal that they're calling the BitLicense.
Right. So you can understand why regulators have their eye on Bitcoin. And certainly New York is not alone. In fact, Peter, in his recent talk at the DC Legal Hackers Group, did a slide presentation. And one of his slides nicely graphically presents some of the most likely candidates who might be interested in regulating Bitcoin. There we go. A whole serious collection of folks. And even if, you know, if just a few of those got involved, it would seriously impact the Bitcoin landscape as we know it now. Why is this such a bad thing, Aaron, that yeah, regulators are interested in Bitcoin for a reason? It's an unregulated currency exchange. So can you at least sort of see the regulatory concern here?
Yeah, so there's definitely valid regulatory concern. You're dealing with value. You're dealing with people's money. You know, it makes sense for regulators to want to step in and provide basic protections to make sure that that money is adequately protected, that your value is not going to get stolen in some way. The problem, or one of the potential problems with this regulation as currently drafted, and I think it's an open question as to whether or not it's going to maintain its current form, is that there's a lot of amazing applications for the technology underlying Bitcoin. There's the real heart of what makes Bitcoin a revolutionary technology is a thing called the blockchain. The blockchain is really a shared database that allows people to transact and share value and soon property and other things without the need for a centralized middleman. So the first application that really uses this technology is Bitcoin, and that enables people to trade money and to exchange that. But the applications for this are vast, and they're going to expand well beyond just currency into digital contracts, which some people are now calling smart contracts, to digital property, to, you know, just really eliminating the need for the middleman in a lot of just everyday websites that we use. You know, using a shared database, you can do things like exchange emails without the need to send it through Gmail, or transact a type of transaction that you do on eBay without the need for having eBay to sit in the middle. So there's a lot of wonderful applications for this that are really not in the financial realm that get potentially swept up by the BitLicense proposal.
Yeah, right. And so go ahead. Is that Peter?
Sorry. Yeah. And so, Denise, that slide with all the regulators on it, I mean, I think what we're dealing with as far as so many different sources of regulatory oversight is we've got federalism. So we've got, there's a lot of the law that you actually need to worry about when it comes to money transmission. A lot of that is a state by state law. And so we've got 50 potential regulators there. And that's, you know, not a threat because of some, you know, evil conspiracy against new technology. That's just the way our current systems are set up. And sometimes our current systems don't work with new technologies right off the bat. And there's going to be a period of adjustment there as we figure out how do we deal with a open protocol that's decentralized and crosses borders, but is currently potentially regulated by individual states, let alone individual countries across the globe. I mean, in the internet space, so for defamation law, which was, of course, because it's common law, was a state court by state court kind of thing. And that was hugely problematic for, say, you know, a big internet company like Google or a small blogger who's in, you know, say, Alabama, and they're suddenly dragged into a court for defamation suit in Oregon. And what was a really fortuitous turn of events in the history of internet policy was that, you know, an interesting sounding law, the Communications Decency Act, which really sounds like it's about censorship, maybe, and originally actually had some, you know, some stronger oversight in it. But ultimately, that law was a preemption, in a way, of defamation law state by state. And so you ended up having to only deal with a federal law to worry about as far as what you're speaking instead of state by state. And this is all going to be very familiar to a bunch of tech lawyers, but I think we're going to see similar things happening. And I'm not saying we're going to see, you know, a bill that preempts state laws anytime soon from Congress, and nor necessarily would we want to. We don't really want to rush these processes and be premature and get something that we didn't realize we actually didn't want. But that's the first thing with this plurality of regulators. And then the second thing is, as Aaron was saying very well, Bitcoin is an interesting thing. It's not just money. And I just said Bitcoin. I really shouldn't. I should say cryptocurrency, because we've got others. We've got the altcoins. We've got new protocols like Ethereum. These are all tools that have, you know, they have basically the blockchain in common. And as Aaron was saying, the blockchain has all these different uses. You can use it to transmit value on a decentralized open protocol. You can use it to register property. You can use it to unlock your car. You can use it, you know, these are all proposed future uses. And so we say, okay, to a regulator, it's not just currency necessarily. It could be a digital commodity or a digital asset. It could be bundled and securitized, you know, or it could be used as a protocol to effectuate different things that you do over a network. And at that point, regulators who they're, you know, very smart people who've had illustrious careers, but this is all new to them. And you're telling them that it's like trying to explain the internet in 1995. Then also at the same time, trying to predict Facebook in 1995, you know, it's not right. Just going to be IRC. It's going to be all these other things.
Right. And for anyone who finds themselves, you know, in the position of having heard of Bitcoin, and you might be somewhat familiar with what a blockchain is, or maybe not. One of the discussion points for our show today is a piece written in January of this year by Mark Andreessen called Why Bitcoin Matters. And I just really highly recommend it. It's great background and great analysis of why this is a technology that has broad application. I'll just read you part of it that sort of sets it up. He's talking about the blockchain and he describes why it's important. Bitcoin is the first practical solution to a longstanding problem in computer science called the Byzantine Generals problem. To quote from the original paper defining the BGP, imagine a group of generals of the Byzantine army camped with their troops around an enemy city. Communicating only by messenger, the generals must agree upon a common battle plan. However, one or more of them may be traitors who will try to confuse the others. The problem is to find an algorithm to ensure that the loyal generals will reach agreement. And then he goes on to say, the practical consequence of solving this problem is that Bitcoin gives us, for the first time, a way for one internet user to transfer a unique piece of digital property to another internet user such that the transfer is guaranteed to be safe and secure. Everyone knows that the transfer has taken place, and nobody can challenge the legitimacy of the transfer. The consequences of this breakthrough are hard to overstate. So let's talk about, you know, people are familiar with Bitcoin. They're familiar with some of the problems that have accompanied Bitcoin's rapid growth and expansion, but they may not be as familiar with some of these alternate technologies that we are alluding to, things, you know, right in the crux of the startup sphere that Aaron deals with. Tell us some of the interesting things that can be done with a blockchain, Aaron, that people might not be thinking about right now.
Sure. And just one other point just on the Mark Andreessen's pieces. I mean, this is a technology that's been 20 years in the making. I mean, this is an issue and a problem that people have been thinking about for 20 years. And the fact that there's a solution now, it's a really big deal. And the applications for the blockchain they're pretty vast. One area that, you know, basically the internet was forged in the early 1990s and everybody really wanted to build a digital currency at that time. There's a bunch of articles written at that point talking about the need to build a digital currency for the internet. If you go and go on Google and search for Milton Friedman, you can actually hear him speaking about this in the early and late 1990s about how a digital currency is going to be brought to life. And now it's finally here. And, you know, one really amazing application for digital currency is that you can actually get smaller than a penny. And that's a big deal because, you know, a lot of things on the internet have a lot of value, but that value might be lower than a penny. And, you know, what people are working to build is systems where micropayments are used to, one, dampen some of the noise that's on the internet. So if every email had a small stamp associated with it, which was a fraction of a penny, the business model for spammers would go away. We could actually have a spam-free internet. And that would be an enormous benefit to everybody who uses the internet. You know, another thing that a lot of people online realize and they don't really have a great solution for is content. You know, content is, you know, it's either locked down or it's freely available. And I don't think anybody is happy with either of those solutions. And there's good arguments, you know, there's arguments on both sides. But one thing that could, you know, be developed with this technology, and I've seen people working towards developing with it, is actually tying micropayments to content. And that means every time you click on a piece of content, a small micropayment would get allocated to the creator of that content. And they would automatically get paid. That could really transform the way we view content online. It would actually incentivize and align everybody's incentives. You'd be actually encouraged at that point to spread it as far and wide as possible if you knew that you would get a small micropayment every time somebody clicked it. So one area that's really exciting about it is micropayments. Yeah.
If I was just going to interject real quickly and then we'll go back to you. So for the people who are copyleft out there, and you know, I've always been interested in the debate. I don't take a strong point of view, but blockchains and these sorts of technologies could also be used for for a system where you don't necessarily demand that people pay to view content, but you do demand some kind of decentralized ledger that proves that content has been borrowed and used by someone else. So you could take Creative Commons and the fantastic, I mean, Creative Commons already hacked the law years ago, and it's pretty awesome.
Right.
You could take their business model and use the blockchain as a database of reputation and attribution. And that would already, I mean, because that's already an incentive for production. But sometimes you say, oh, I want to attribute to somebody, but I don't know. This picture came up on Imgur or on Reddit, and I have no idea where it originated. If we could find a way to do that, that's fantastic as well. Anyway,
yeah.
So, so back to you, Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the, you know, once you start thinking of internet that has micropayments attached to it, you can also do some really interesting things. For example, you could have remix fees associated with them. So, you know, one issue with the internet is, you know, how do you compensate people if they're using their content and they want to do something else with it? Well, you know, if you knew that you could get a piece of that in the form of a remix fee of some sort, then that would be a pretty interesting, thing to do. And, you know, in a world where there's micropayments and that's something that becomes available. And I think, you know, we're going to start seeing these types of systems develop pretty rapidly over, you know, the next, you know, 5 years. Maybe that's a too short of a time horizon. Maybe it's 7 to 10 years. But I think this is something people are working towards, and there's a lot of value that people perceive in it. So it's something that's going to be, you're going to see a lot of innovation with. You know, the second area, along with micropayments, is actually the ability to digitize a contract. If you think about what a contract is at a basic level, it's really just the execution of a condition. Many parts of a contract, but not all of them. But, you know, if an event occurs, you know, then a second event happens, and a contract is a series of those conditions. And using new technology, there's a couple of projects that have basically built the ability to build immutable digital contracts. And that's also going to be a very important development in terms of the internet. We just talked about micro payments. Well, you know, it's highly likely that associated with micro payments will be micro contracts. So very small contracts that a lot of people enter into over a long period, you know, as they surf around the internet, that just allocate resources. Along with, you know, some of the traditional law that, you know, we practice as lawyers, could, you know, pieces of that, not all of it, but pieces of that could actually get automated through, you know, these contracts. So that's another exciting part of that. And kind of an extension of micro contracts is a whole slew of other things that, you know, we know about today and we use in finance and other areas. So there's smart equity, which would be the idea of using, smart contracts and other blockchain technology to help people raise money online, in any way that they could conceivably imagine. And there's also the idea for smart finance, which would be the idea of using basically smart contracts and or micro contracts to enable people to build and create financial products that are traded on major markets. These are really exciting. This is really exciting technology. But going back to that, all the parties that could potentially regulate this space, it really starts to bump into a lot of areas, where there's heavy regulatory schemes. So there's going to be a lot of tension here. And I think, at a fundamental level, you know, the internet and the advances in computing basically put a copy machine in everybody's pocket. Now everybody has that, computer in their pocket, and the blockchain is going to really enable people to have a commercial bank in their pocket, an investment bank, and a law firm in their pocket. And, you know, a world that has, that much power on an individual level requires, a lot of thought and consideration to think about how we should be dealing with this technology.
Right. As Aaron hinted, on that slide of the many different regulators, one of them is the CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. They just had an event yesterday. Their Global Markets Advisory Committee heard testimony from a number of people in the space who are trying to either do something with a commodity trading instrument with Bitcoin, or maybe even do commodity trading instruments through Bitcoin. And our executive director, Jerry, testified along with some people who are from the startup space there. And also, we have a link to Hooman Shadab's piece on smart contracts. He's a law professor at New York Law School. But what I think is really interesting about this testimony, about watching how regulators are coming to view these issues, or just coming to even be aware that they exist, is that there are two things to think about if you're the CFTC. And they're just beginning to think about these things, and it'll be interesting to see how it changes. The first thing is, can we have dollar-denominated currency swaps that would actually enable people to watch the price of Bitcoin and put in an order to buy or sell at different prices, so that they can automatically hedge the risk of price volatility. So if you're an innovator, if you have a startup that's going to use Bitcoin in some way, one of the things you would worry about, of course, is that you're going to be holding some Bitcoin as an organization. And by holding that Bitcoin with the price volatility being high, because you can get pretty big swings in the price of Bitcoin in a given day. I think the average on a given day is something like 3.5%, but sometimes we see 20, of course, and it always hits the headlines. But it's a new asset. It's exotic. People are still figuring out how they feel about it. You got a lot of new entrants. But if you're holding that as part of your business, that is a liability. So if there's a way to hedge that holding through a traditional dollar-denominated security, basically a commodity security, then that really enables you to offload some of your risk onto a financial market that's willing to hold it. So that's huge. And that's coming soon, already from a group called Terra Exchange, a company called Terra Exchange, which is building this commodity instrument on Bitcoin. But that's just a traditional commodities instrument that is the commodity in question is Bitcoin. The other question is, can we do commodities trading through the Bitcoin protocol or through some other cryptographic protocol? Because as Aaron was saying, we can program ex ante these very complicated transactions that say, they have conditions. They're just if-then structures, just like normal contracts. If the price hits this, sell this many. That can all be done through automation. That's going to be a big change. I mean, of course, we're still going to need lots of humans involved in the process to help set these things up and make sure they run well. But you get a lot of security from offloading the actual, initiation and then completion of these things to a network that will automate it. And it'll be interesting to see how the CFTC eventually comes around to feeling about that, how they'll regulate those transactions when they're not happening in traditional exchanges, when they're actually happening on a blockchain. I think they're just getting started with that. And it's very exciting to see testimony like this, because you get to see people's eyes light up as they think, oh gosh, there's new stuff out there. And you hope you don't see anyone's eyes light up and say, oh gosh, I'm going to be replaced by a machine, because that's also not entirely true. I mean, we create jobs when we destroy them in this sense, because someone has to use the machines and people are messy. You can't really tailor all the needs of a person with a robot. You need a person to deal with the person, and then the better tool to do that interaction is the robot. So I think that's, anyway, it's all very interesting. I hope I didn't freak anyone out or get weird.
Well, no, but you could very well freak out, I think, lawmakers with the conversation, yes, that we're having here today. Off the top of my head, I have so many questions, by the way, that have all flowed from the last 10 minutes of conversation. I hope to get to at least some of them. But the first one relates to the most recent topic, and that is both the fluctuation of the value of Bitcoin and the notion that you could offload some of the risk and have a commodities market. Our securities infrastructure is one of the most, at least in the U.S., highly and tightly regulated commercial enterprises that we have in existence. And so when you float these ideas by lawmakers that we're going to have this very automated kind of financial infrastructure, where the price fluctuates wildly and, you could potentially displace things like the existing commodities infrastructure with it. I could see a lot of freak out happening. I could see, the people wanting to, we have regulations in place to control price fluctuation. We have certain regulations in place to control misuse of automation in the securities realm. Of course, it happens anyway. That's a whole other can of worms. But I think, you guys probably there is a reason why it would be much harder to see the kinds of misuse with technology in financial transactions that we sometimes see in the stock market, where people are beating each other by a fraction of a second to squeeze out an additional gain from a transaction. That would probably, strikes me intuitively, be difficult to do when you're using a distributed blockchain, because there's no way to really game that, right?
I mean, in terms of gaming the system, I think the advantage for people who are in finance is that if you have these self-executing contracts, they could be potentially quicker. Things that are quicker in finance, enable more efficient and liquid markets. So that's the advantage to it. I think in terms of regulators looking at this, if something looks like a traditional financial instrument, it clearly makes sense that, a U.S. regulator would look at it. But I think you bump into the same issues that we faced on the internet. I mean, you can't stop somebody from going to another jurisdiction where they might permit this and, opening up an exchange of some sort. Once the cat's out of the bag, it's really hard to stuff it back in and shut the door once it hits the internet. And I think that, the same issues that, media companies and content companies have faced in terms of dealing with the spread of content online, I think you're going to see similar things with regard to finance online. But I think, even more interesting and presenting new opportunities and challenges is that it's going to be a lot easier for people to issue things that look a lot like securities or commodities. There's been a number of projects where artists and other people are issuing their own coins. They're issuing their own alternative coins that are built on similar technology as Bitcoin, and they're using it to basically, fund themselves. And the gist of the idea is, get in, before I'm huge and, buy a bunch of my, self-issued currency, my Beyonce coins. As I get bigger and bigger, and, I get huger and huger, the value of that commodity would go up. I don't know the minds of the regulators, but I don't know how they would react if there's millions of people who are issuing their own coins. What's the right way to respond to that? I think that's a really difficult question. And I think in watching the internet evolve, we've seen that when these types of technologies hit the mass, with music and MP3s and other things like that, that they really raise difficult questions for lawmakers, where there's not really clear answers on the right way to proceed.
Also, right. I'm somewhat optimistic in the long run that regulators will not only become comfortable with blockchains, but they'll actually see them as an amazing tool for their own law enforcement purposes. And I don't mean spying on people. I know that's immediately what a lot of people are going to think is, Peter at Coin Center is saying, I'm not even going to finish that quote because I'll be quoted on it. But what I mean is, so if someone was to set up a new stock exchange using internet technology pre-blockchain, you'd say, who the heck are you? It's sort of like somebody set up eBay. And at first people were saying, really, you're going to give your credit card number to the stranger over the internet and they're going to, give you a good? But that system evolved, and it evolved to use reputation as a mechanism for, doing some degree of consumer protection. You shouldn't be buying from someone who someone else previously said had fraud. But you still had to trust eBay, actually, that the reviews being posted were valid. And this is the same question that comes up with, say, services like Yelp these days. Like, are they gaming reputational systems? So the trust that you have to have in the person who's starting the business is a little high in the early days of the internet. What blockchains afford you is it's this decentralized network. So it's very much like the internet itself. It's running through TCP/IP, but it's actually a protocol of its own for provably sending things from one place to another and saying it's been destroyed on this side and it now exists on this side. And the process of how that happens, provably saying it's gone here, there's no fraud, it's gone, I didn't make a copy, I didn't forge a new dollar, and saying that it's now over here, that process is also transparent. Bitcoin is open source software, effectively. You can actually go, I think to GitHub, I should know that for sure, but I think to GitHub, and you can see the actual source code of Bitcoin. And, you know, so there's still a level of trust for someone who's not like a really high, you know, high power coder. Like I would not be able to say, yeah, that looks mathematically secure. But a regulator could easily hire someone who's, you know, brilliant and who would actually look at everything that happens, all the math that happens to move the asset from here to here or to bundle the security and say, it would be very difficult to game this, you know, as an expert, you know, me being a fake expert. As an expert, I don't think I could game this. And not only that, say take Bitcoin right now, there's about $5 billion worth of value in there. That's a pretty, you know, cushy incentive to go break the thing if you're someone with, you know, bad ends, if you're a nasty person. And thus far, we see people infiltrate the exchanges, you know, some of the centralized ways to access the protocol. But we haven't seen someone actually, you know, in mass steal things from the protocol or game the protocol itself.
And that's because the protocol is wrapped in cryptography. And, you know, this cryptography is mathematically sound. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people who are building this technology. You know, they say that it's all wrapped and it's encrypted, and until quantum computing gets invented, it's going to be, you know, difficult to to peer in and understand and decipher all of the cryptography that's being applied into this into this system. I think beyond just the source code being open source, you know, it's a shared database. So you also have a record of every single transaction. So you can go and download, you know, any of these blockchains that are on there, if it's Bitcoin or some of these altcoins, and you can get a full history of every single event that happened in the network using that blockchain. So from the very first moment, the Genesis block, you know, to the latest, the latest time that the entire network synchronized. And that's a really powerful thing. That means, you know, you can start, you know, you can run metrics on the entire database. You can know that, a person with a certain wallet, you know, transferred funds from one wallet to another wallet. And, you know, there is a high degree of transparency to these systems in terms of events occurring without actually the substance of the underlying event. It's kind of like, you know that you've got a safety deposit box, but you don't know exactly what's inside the safety deposit box. But if somebody moved the safety deposit box and it left the bank and put it into another bank, you would know, that event occurred. And that's very powerful.
Okay, I want to move away from the 10,000 foot level in a moment here and more into some specifics, some of which we've touched on. But before we do that, I want to do two things. First, I want to put our first MCLE passphrase into the show, and that's going to be law firm in your pocket, harkening back to something Aaron said a moment ago. So we put these passphrases in the show in case you are listening to the show for continuing legal or other professional education credit. We have more information about CLE in the 50 United States at our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. If you find the This Week in Law page there, it will give you some information about your jurisdiction if you're interested in looking into that. And we put these phrases in because some of the jurisdictions like you to be able to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened. So that's why we do it. Secondly, we haven't been hearing much from Warren Allen on the show yet, and I suspect that's because, Warren, you're sitting there taking furious notes, because as someone in charge of a legal hacking movement where, you know, the idea is to put smart lawyers and technologists in a room and try and figure out practical solutions to problems, You know, and especially being in New York with the Department of Financial Services there, looking into licensing people working with Bitcoin. Why don't you tell us, Warren, what your approach would be toward tackling the complexity of regulating this burgeoning ecosystem, and whether you guys have done any work on that already?
Well, we definitely haven't up here in New York, but I obviously DC's gotten some great presentations happening on this already, and it's something we've got to check out and put on the list of many things that we want to do. But you know, just from a pure thinking about the regulation of Bitcoin at this point, I mean, it's really, you know, I think some of the analogies so far have been comparing back to the early days of the internet, and someone mentioned CDA 230 and provisions like that, where you had the federal government sort of stepping in and saying, you know, hands off for now in terms of talking to the state regulators and state, you know, state causes of action, taking this particular technology, saying let's you know, sort of see where this goes and see how we should really wind up treating this. You know, I think that's something that's really going to be important for sort of stimulating, you know, growth and encouraging development of the new kinds of technologies that we're, you know, we're talking about here. Obviously, you know, it's a pretty exciting area. If you have 50 state regulators plus the federal government, and then we're not even talking about all the different potential connections that you could have internationally, the European states, you know, anyone else with a potential interest, if they all impose their own regimes, it becomes pretty next to impossible to comply, and, you know, potentially impossible, I would think, from the regulator's side to even enforce. So I think, you know, establishing some sort of basic protections and preemptive ground rules, I guess, you know, could really be a huge step in allowing cool things to continue to happen. So that's one point that I would definitely make on that side. Another point, I think, is that it's really interesting to think about, you know, potential security instruments in the Bitcoin space, because you're really talking about something that a lot of the potential investing public doesn't really, I think, fully understand at this point. You know, if I try to talk about Bitcoin, and I certainly don't have nearly the level of understanding of it that you know, I think everyone, the other guests here do. So, you know, if I try to talk about it with just, you know, some of my friends, they may not really have a full grasp on it either. And talking about it as a potential investment vehicle, where the importance of, you know, our regulation regime right now is conveying information so that the consumer of, you know, the investment can make a smart, informed decision. You know, that's a pretty steep hurdle at this point, I think, to climb. So, you know, that's just something I'm making as an observation based on the conversation mm-hmm. we're having here. But it's super interesting, definitely, at this point. And I think that, you know, it's going to be exciting no matter what. And I'm curious to hear what thoughts you might have on that point.
Anybody want to bite on that?
I mean, I think the big thing is, it's really to start thinking that this technology is just broader than finance. It's really the blockchain. It's a shared right. database. You know, it, just like if you thought of the internet as email back in 1998, that would have been problematic, because, you know, there's mm-hmm. a lot more that's going on and that we've all seen happen over the past, you know, almost 15 years. You know, once we saw the internet browser and the development of like the hypertext protocol and all these other amazing things that, you know, that we're interacting with on a daily basis. You know, if we stopped, you know, 1998 and said, you know, and just said, we're going to only allow email, and only allow this technology called the internet to really deal with email, you know, we would have lost a tremendous amount of value. And that would have been really bad for this country. It would have been really bad for the world. And, you know, we're facing a situation, again, where we have a just as a highly disruptive, although that term is cliched, technology, And, you know, we're facing situations where regulators are rightfully, you know, popping up their heads and saying, you know, we need to look at this more deeply. But, you know, caution, you know, might be a good idea here to see how this is developing. You know, every month a brand new technology is being used or developed using this technology. And, you know, my concern is that, you know, if we act too quickly and we act too rashly, that will really destroy a lot of value and a lot of, you know, great things that we can do to really help the entire world.
Yeah, that just could not be a go ahead, Peter, finish your thought. And then I'm going to take us into some of those specifics.
Sure. Sorry, it's Warren. I just wanted to add one final point. It's what I just wanted to follow up on that, you know, just thinking because there were certain, you know, when email was developed, you know, you wound up with spam, and shortly after you got spam, you got anti-spam laws. So you definitely, I mean, it's interesting because we do have specific regulations and laws that affect elements of, you know, certain facets of the internet. So I think that's an interesting sort of comparison. You could have very carefully framed laws regarding certain uses of Bitcoin again, but I think you're probably right that at this point it's too young a technology to really figure out what all those potential uses could be and how you'd want to really frame the regulation of them.
And yeah, as Aaron said, it's very interesting that actually, you know, sometimes it's not just how do we deal with this as a regulatory problem, it's how do we use this to deal with existing regulatory problems. So Aaron was explaining how you could put a little stamp on emails, and that would actually be a really good way of disincentivizing people from spamming because they can't send thousands and thousands of emails because it starts to actually become costly at that point. Or, you know, digital copyright, as Aaron was saying. And I think a big one, too, is consumer protection.
Right.
We'll be filing another comment to the New York Department of Financial Services about the BitLicense. And one of the things we want to stress is right now in this country, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, we in 2012 alone, we had $30 billion worth of costs in identity fraud. Or an identity theft, and that's a massive problem that needs to be solved. And there are some interesting new technologies that are, you know, slowly emerging from Bitcoin, which right now we see as a very, you know, shifty, confusing, possibly scary asset. But there's a technology called multi-signature transactions, wherein you put three keys on a wallet, and you have your Bitcoins there. And then you go to pay for something at a store, and two of those keys have to be turned in order to send the funds to the person at the store. And let's say we have the three keys, the customer has two, but only one of them's on their phone, and then an intermediary, which is doing fraud protection, has the third. So when the customer goes to pay for the thing at the store, the customer's phone initiates the transaction. The fraud protection service watches and says, oh, yeah, he's buying something at the normal bodega outside of his apartment. Of course, you know, confirm. The transaction goes through. But if, on the other hand, somebody steals the person's phone and it's in, like, evil hands, and this person tries to transfer all of the Bitcoins or cryptocurrency out of the person's wallet, you know, the fraud protection service will look at that and say, well, I don't know who you're sending this to, and you're sending all of your money away. I think this is not you. I think this is your phone being stolen. I'm not going to sign off on the transaction. And the thief just has one key. They have the phone because the actual user, they kept their other key secret in a safe deposit box in a bank or maybe, you know, in their sock drawer or something. And so you get this really neat mathematically based fraud protection that is much superior than our current, you know, our currently massively problematic, as exemplified by Target and Home Depot and the JP Morgan breach, massively fraud payment system right now when it comes to the risk of identity theft. And so that should be an opportunity. You know, that should be something a regulator sees and goes, oh, cool. We can use these tools and we can, you know, ask people, we can ask companies to use these tools, because these tools make our job of safeguarding our constituents that much easier.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And we hope that some of them will begin paying attention and looking at Bitcoin as not something to be controlled, but to be monitored and developed and used productively. Let's take a break. If you're like me, we've been going along. We've been terribly interested in this discussion. This happens to me all the time where I'm just too busy living my life to eat. I want you to take a break now and think about whether you have given yourself sufficient nutrition. And in order to help you do that in a healthy way, I'd like to let you know that our show today is brought to you by NatureBox. Right now, NatureBox is giving you a chance to get a free trial box of their most popular snacks. And I'm very, very serious. This happens to me all the time. I get up in the morning, I have some coffee and maybe a light snack and go through my day. And before I know it, it's 4 or 4:30 in the afternoon and I haven't eaten a thing. And at that point, I am absolutely starving. And wherever I am, whatever is food, you know, I'm going to reach for it and just gobble it down because I need something to keep going. So that is why it's so great to keep NatureBox on hand. It gets you away from the vending machine. That's why vending machines exist, right? Because you're at work or you're at school or, you know, in some other environment where you're just too busy to think about eating and you've got to grab something quick. Well, of course, the stuff that is generally there for you to grab is not very good for you. So if you keep NatureBox on hand, that helps go a long way towards solving that problem. I will give you the caveat that if you're not alone in your home, that, you know, keeping your NatureBox to yourself, you know, maybe we could put it all on the blockchain and then you could monitor, you know, who had the who devoured all the sea salt pop pops. These are going fast in my house right now.
That's not that far-fetched.
There we go. The Big Island pineapple also has been very popular.
And your fridge could be programmed to order even more,
exactly.
You know?
That's right. Yeah, it would need to. Although, you know, NatureBox makes that.
From NatureBox.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. They make that super simple right now because you just, you know, you set up your recurring order and your fridge doesn't have to get involved. But really, it's very hard for me. I almost feel like, you know, when I used to have this problem the most is when I was working at an office and you're sharing the refrigerator there with all your coworkers. And of course, you know, notoriously people put little Post-its and things on their stuff in the fridge. And I'm very tempted to label our NatureBox supplies so that they don't get all gobbled down before we can all enjoy them. But so far, I haven't had to resort to that. The most current box I got also had, I've been showing you the whole wheat blueberry Figgy Bars, the Big Island Pineapple, the Sea Salt Pop Pops. And these are mini medjools dates. And here in Southern California, you know, in Northern California, people are all about the wine and knowing all about the wine and the various varietals and, you know, where it's grown and what that means. Here in Southern California, we're a little bit like that with dates because they grow out in the desert here. And there are all different varieties that we get in our grocery stores. And I've got to say that these mini medjools that we got from NatureBox are just absolutely delicious and make a very fine date shake. If you've never had a date shake, look it up and make yourself one. They are delicious. And NatureBox has hundreds of delicious snacks. The great thing is that you don't feel guilty about eating them. When I grab for them, I know that, you know, if I've forgotten to eat, I'm putting something good into my body. It's better for me than anything else I might grab for because get this, they've got zero artificial colors, flavors, or sweeteners, 0 grams of trans fats, and no high fructose corn syrup. You'll even find snacks without added sugar and without gluten if those things are important to you too. So in the afternoon when you're hungry, do what I do. Grab apple cinnamon crave from NatureBox or sriracha roasted cashews or cranberry macaroon granola. It's all so good. And the variety is just incredible. You're going to find out way more when you go to the site and you start picking out what you like. It's so much better for you than other snack options out there. You should just go ahead and start your free trial. Get a free sampler box at naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong, and start snacking smarter. Go to naturebox.com/twit. Thank you so much, NatureBox, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, we have some very specific applications of blockchain technology. We've touched on some of them, and we'll get into some that we haven't mentioned. Let's start now with spam. We've been talking about spam and how it was one of the primary reasons the internet started to be regulated in the first place. Now we have a new technology that could perhaps do away with the need for regulation of spam because it would make it technologically unadvantageous. Could you go a little deeper on that, Aaron, and tell us exactly? It seems to me like what you're saying is that in order to send an email, there would be some, even if it's a tiny, financial consequence to doing so. Is that what you're envisioning?
Yeah. So think about a spammer's business model is let's send millions of pieces of email or million posts to, you know, various blogs or other things like that. And hope we get, you know, a small fraction of them to click a link and a small fraction of them to, you know, buy a product or enter into some scam that we're running. And then we make our money and, you know, we're happy and everybody else on the, you know, the internet is, you know, crying. So the idea is, you know, if you actually just put a very small, payment, you know, 0.0005 cents or something like that, that would be enough to just basically obliterate that business model. And it wouldn't be feasible for them, for anybody to do that. You know, the big technical limitation is, okay, that's great, but how do we ensure that we have micropayments kind of hardwired into the internet? And that's what people are working on. I mean, there's a project called Ethereum, and they're, you know, working hard to basically build a general purpose computational machine that would that has a browser that basically has the blockchain just built into it, just like how HTTP is built into the browser now. They would have their blockchain built into the browser of the future, and it would enable these types of transactions.
It seems to me a little bit scary for people who see the internet as a great egalitarian tool that anyone, even people with very marginal resources, can find a way to access and use, you know, at their public library or at their school. And that if we're talking about taking something that is freely accessible now, or various aspects of it, and putting even micropayments on them, that could be problematic in an access to the resource kind of way, don't you think?
Sure, I think that's right. You know, I think what they're envisioning, it would be backwards compatible. So whatever's freely available now would continue to be available. You know, this could be an additional add-on. You know, you could imagine a service where you get normal email and maybe that has some spam with it. But if you wanted to, you know, pay 50 cents a month, you could have a spam-free email box or something like that. But I think that that's a really good concern. I mean, this technology isn't perfect. I think it's going to have a lot of downsides to it too. But I think on balance, the benefit would...
I think you could actually pay the person who you're sending the email to read it. I mean, no, because just as a spam protection method, because we already sort of do this with LinkedIn, right? You can buy extra credits in order to contact people who are far away from you. And people could set, like, in order to even get into my priority inbox, you're going to need this many coins attached to your email. I don't know if I like this idea. It sounds kind of, I don't know, but it's fascinating. It's sorry, I just had a thought.
gaming the inbox. But
yeah,
I mean, certainly business models have, technology business models have been built around the notion of paying the customer. Remember the free PC where the person was agreeing to get pummeled with lots of ads.
Those pop-up ads. I remember that.
Right.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like the greatest thing in the world, but it could work.
Well, and this is something that's very interesting with Bitcoin or with cryptocurrencies, is that you could build this system wherein you want to build in some costs to make things run better, because scarcity allows us to figure out how to allocate resources. You know, we do it based on demand. But instead of having some centralized authority decide how to price things or how to screen things on the internet, you could literally just enact it through a neutral platform and have the actual user decide what they want to price their time at. I'd rather pay the person who I want the attention of than pay the intermediary that's going to, you know, be the gateway to my getting their attention. Maybe, you know, if I have to pay it all. I'd rather not pay it all.
Right. And maybe it makes sense. I mean, just sort of, you know, thought of experimenting this as we are here. Maybe it makes sense if the person who is trying to contact you is a perfect stranger, not someone you're close to and familiar with, that if there is some sort of financial gain involved in you clicking on that email. Maybe, you know.
And this is just a great example. Like, this is a conversation that we're all just having. None of us are actually going to start this business, but we're all thinking, oh, wait, there's all these possibilities. You could do it this way. You could do it that way. It's got to look a lot like the internet looked in 1995 for someone who is really interested in it. Like, oh, wow, we can do this and we can do this. And, and so those are like, those are the many, 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 many possibilities that Aaron's been talking about and that we've been talking about that we really hope are preserved and that, you know, some degree of light touch regulation allows to continue.
So let's look at the micropayments for content concept. There's an article out there about Bitcoin saving journalism. This is in our rundown at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/278. All the things we're talking about today are in there if you want to look at, and there's some great content in there. I really encourage people to read the articles that we're talking about and that have sort of teed up the show today for us. But how Bitcoin could save journalism and the arts is the article at time.com. So let's talk about that for a moment. And also, I guess we can fold into this discussion the group that you're working with, Aaron, called Monograph, which is about creating a registry that helps create scarcity for digital art. How can Bitcoin help people who write and create and hope to be paid for it?
Sure. So, you know, Monograph is a really interesting project that's started by an NYU art professor here in New York. You know, he came up with an amazingly brilliant idea. He has created scarcity in a digital world using the blockchain. You know, the blockchain is a shared database, and what it can do is it can also record and timestamp things, and it can create worldwide property registries. So using this technology, it's conceivable we could have a worldwide copyright registry, a worldwide trademark registry. And one, you know, area where there's a lot of registries is the art world. You know, that's how they keep track of art and make sure that they're getting appropriate title to artwork. And what Monograph does is it basically allows you to take a digital piece of art that you've made and pronounce to the world and timestamp it so that everybody knows that that is the unique first original version of the artwork that's been created. What the people at Monograph think can be generated from that is a market around that. So a lot of artists now are not really painting anymore. They're using their computers and making this amazing digital art, and they have a hard time selling that art. One example is they actually recently found all this digital art that that Andy Warhol made, and there needs to be a way for people to be able to, you know, mathematically verify that this is the original. This is the absolute only copy that matters that I'm gaining ownership of. So what Monograph is hoping to do is to create this system that could allow artists to sell their artwork and create scarcity around something that, you know, probably should have a bit of scarcity to it.
Wow, that's a fascinating idea. So it sort of bundles in the whole concept of DRM without actual DRM.
Yeah, it's not
or
DRM.
It?
You know, there's no DRM.
It's just a registry.
DRM. Then. Yeah, and I think the idea is to wrap it around something that I was talking about before, which would be, you know, some sort of container where you could, you know, collect payments if it was put on another site or something else like that. And that's all getting kind of worked out. But the idea is really, you know, digital content is fabulous. It can spread everywhere. But, you know, there is some pockets where scarcity matters and, where scarcity has a premium. And using a blockchain, you can actually, begin to create a space for that and a market for that. But beyond just, art, the idea, you know, maybe it's because I've been a practicing lawyer, especially in the intellectual property space. But, you know, all of these intellectual property registries are highly inefficient. We're at a point where we can technically build something that looks like a global copyright registry, where you could actually just drag and drop something onto a blockchain and, you know, everybody around the globe could do it. And, you know, we could say, this is, you know, the original work and I'm claiming ownership of it. Or, you know, this is the trademark that I want to file and I'm claiming ownership of it. And, you know, that would create huge amounts of efficiency. And I know I know that, you know, if you even take it beyond intellectual property, but to actual real property, you could imagine a worldwide property exchange where it would be just as easy for people to buy a piece of property in the U.S. as it would be in another country. I mean, if we had a system like that, the amount of efficiency that would be presented would be astronomical.
Right. So let's stay on the art metaphor for a moment. I'm an artist. I've created an original, you know, I want to create a digital work that sort of mirrors what I would do in the real world. I'm going to create an original and maybe 10 lithographs, you know, the digital equivalent of a lithograph of my original. And so the original is going to sell for more. I'm going to have 10 that are technically they're identical copies of the original because that's how digital artifacts work. You make an identical copy, or maybe I suppose you could slightly change each of the lithographs, but then that would be that. And you would be able to control that using the blockchain without DRM, and that would be one business model. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's the gist of it. Yeah, you would record it and be able to transfer title to that record so that somebody could, you know, wave a, you know, the equivalent of like a digital piece of paper and say, you know, no, I own the original and here's my proof that I own the original.
Although,
and that's why,
to be clear,
that's why you should pay for more.
To be clear, I feel that, so if the artwork is, and this is just me thinking through this, if the artwork is displayed on a screen and you can see it, there has to be some process that makes that visible, that like decrypts it from the blockchain and makes it visible. And it's only going to allow you to decrypt it when you are the rightful holder on the ledger. So to be clear, I feel like we'd still need digital rights management of a sort.
You
need to use cryptography to make that visible. What otherwise would be not visible would be a scrambled thing on the blockchain or a scrambled thing somewhere that you decrypt using the blockchain.
No, it would be just, you know, you can take every digital file is just a series of bits, zeros and ones, and you can create a unique hash for that file. And that file is, that hash is what gets registered to the blockchain.
Right. But if it wasn't encrypted, you could copy it and send it. You could make a copy of the fourth lithograph and then you haven't really solved this scarcity problem because you'd have piracy still.
There definitely could be people who make copies and, you know, change a bit and make it something else. But the point is not the way it would work is not that it would create some sort of it wouldn't wrap it and make it obscured until you had rights to view it. It would just allow somebody to say, you know, here is an original piece of artwork and this is the actual original. And if other people use it, you know, there's not much you can do about it. But knowing just as a verifiable fact, this is the original, that the artist intended to be the original, you know, the thesis is that that will create value for that item. And in the art world, where I think you know, people want to have the original, being able to prove that should enable, you know, digital artists to get compensated, you know, for their artwork at higher levels than they are today. And I think that would be a very valuable thing.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to poo-poo the idea. I think it's a great idea. It's interesting that you could also try and do it with DRM, which I'm sure somebody will. You know, if the RIAA ever gets hip to Bitcoin, we're all screwed, right? So maybe nobody will buy their blockchain products. But right. I feel like you could do it with cryptography and DRM too, and we'll see if that happens. But I like the getting the warm fuzzies from knowing you've got copy three. I think that's cool too.
Right. Well, okay, so let's look at the alternate universe of journalism and writing, and they have, or you know, I mean, we could look at music and movies and TV too, all of which are very freely copied. The rights holders are up in arms because their works get copied whole or in part without their permission, readily available elsewhere on the net. Monetized elsewhere on the net through ads, they want to put a stop to that. They also probably, let's stick with journalism and keep our brains on one channel here. Say I'm the New York Times or local newspaper or Mashable or whomever. I am a known brand with a known audience and I am putting out good content. And I want there to be both fair uses of my content and licensed uses of my content, but I don't want there to be unlicensed uses. And I want to be able to control those. How does the blockchain step in there, Peter?
Oh, it's sort of the same idea, is that you'd use some form of encryption on the data that you wanted to read. And the only way to de-encrypt that is to have a ledger truthfully show that you've made the micropayment that corresponds to getting the key to then read the encrypted digital content.
Or in the case of something like a license, like you were talking about earlier with Creative Commons, there wouldn't necessarily need to be a payment as long as the parties were in agreement that the use was okay, right?
Right. I mean, the great thing about micropayments is when we're talking about paying for content, we could be talking about fractions of a penny. We could even be talking of fractions of a penny. So you want to have some sort of token. You need to have some sort of token to actually show that something has moved from being held by one person to another person. But we do this in contracts. You know, we call it consideration, and we say, we'll have the law does not inquire into the actual value of the consideration. We just need to know that there was real consideration given, and then the law will recognize that as a contract. So what you could do is have this registry of who read whose things or who borrowed from whose things and modified them, and there'd be this sort of token consideration, this tiny micropayment that was paid to symbolize that interaction between two people. And so we're not talking about, oh, you're never going to be able to mix up Beyonce and Gautier unless you pay $50,000. We're saying you're not going to be able to mix them up unless you pay 0.000003 of a penny, because we want to immortalize the fact that you've done this so that Beyonce and Gautier, well, they don't really need the credit, but so some obscure artist actually knows that this has happened and they actually get the credit for the original.
Is there a privacy concern here? I mean, obviously all of our activities on the net as we speak now without having everything live on a blockchain are tracked as much as they can be by people who want to track and use that data.
Exactly.
But it seems like when it is all in a ledger, that becomes even more problematic potentially,
see,
or no?
I disagree that this is what's really cool about this. Is so Creative Commons, from what I understand, and I've never actually been on the inside of that organization, but when they were rolling out the Creative Commons licenses, there was this internal discussion like, oh, should we try and make sure that people attribute by keeping a registry? How would we do that with existing technology back then in the beginning of the 2000s? And the feeling was, gosh, the only way we're going to be able to do that is with cookies or with clear pixels. And we're basically doing pretty draconian private surveillance of all the people that use Creative Commons. And that's totally like the Venn diagram of people that like cookies and people that like Creative Commons. It's not really connected. I mean, there's some connection. They all work at Google, I think. But now we have this alternative way of building a registry. And so you don't need to spy on everyone, i.e. every time somebody, you know, comes across a website without even realizing what they've come across, a cookie is saved or a clear pixel is saved. We say, no, if you want to use the thing in a certain way, then you have to voluntarily transact with the person and immortalize that. So I mean, what's the difference between privacy or being violated and just living publicly and being social? You know, what's the difference between Facebook and the NSA? Well, it's voluntary choice. And the blockchain can immortalize that voluntary choice that you made rather than just immortalize the fact that you accidentally stumbled across something. At least I think that makes some sense as a distinction.
So,
Aaron,
just
any thoughts
question
on that?
From me.
Or is that Warren?
Yeah. Yes.
It's Warren. I just actually had a question because, you know, it seems to me that, you know, we're talking about a technology, and it seems like, technology doesn't really, it's not really going to be good or bad, but it could, you know, I think we could definitely see some negative uses, like we're talking about the RIAA and, you know, definitely, and also talking about potentially, you know, clearly it can be used to protect privacy. I'm also seeing just, thinking through some of the examples that, you know, it could also be used to provide really tight, you know, lockdown surveillance on people, potentially, depending on how it was the technology wound up being implemented. So, I mean, I guess my question, I think, would be from people who are on the front lines of dealing with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and this kind of technology is, how do you sort of set the right norms so that we wind up getting good uses? And I think, going back to our earlier discussion, good uses will at least help in staving off bad regulation. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of set up those kinds of norms that you wind up with the kinds of good uses that allow us to keep creating cool technology?
I mean, I think that's why we need organizations like Legal Hackers. I'm not just buying Seriously. You off with praise, but you know, matching the technologists who will build these technologies with lawyers who really want to solve, you know, because some of us get into law for the money, but I think a lot of us get into law because we see it as the sort of, I think Richard Epstein, who's a beloved professor of mine, says that, you know, politicians and economists and public policy people, they like to take the view from 10,000 feet and point the ship of policy in one direction. It's the lawyers that are down in the bowels of the ship, shoveling coal into the boilers and figuring out how to make the whole damn thing work. And Bitcoin and cryptographic technologies are a real opportunity to give amazingly powerful technological tools to individuals as opposed to a big organization, as opposed to a government organization, or as opposed to a big corporation like Facebook, and say, actually, we can build this amazingly organized governance just from piecemeal actions of this lawyer working with this smart contract, working with this smart property, and building a kind of interaction amongst those people voluntarily. That's an amazing thing. That hasn't happened so much before, not in the world of physical value. It's only happened in the world of the internet, which is this sort of, you know, you'll have organizations like Creative Commons come up and say, oh, hey, the internet's here. We can create a way of having standardized licenses that are less draconian than traditional copyright protections, and we can spread them all over. So getting like really interesting people like Creative Commons involved with Bitcoin, I think that's a huge win. Or getting the people who go to the Legal Hackers meetup, who are the next Larry Lessigs out there to hack on Bitcoin and to learn how to hack on Bitcoin. That's going to be amazing. You know, I'm very optimistic, which is, of course, why I work at a place like Coin Center, I suppose. But
yes. Let's talk about some other getting to the, you know, good uses, encouraging good policy question. There's a piece at the Wall Street Journal talking about Bitcoin fighting the Ebola crisis, could find, you know, this is like just the greatest confluence of headline grabbers, Bitcoin and Ebola in the same headline.
We forgot ISIS, but we really don't want
ISIS. So, Aaron, you want to take a stab at how Bitcoin and or blockchain technology could help
fight
contain
Ebola.
The terrible Ebola.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was classic link bait, but you know, the gist of it was it's really you know, what Bitcoin can do, and one of the first applications that people see is really to build a global payment system. And you know, it's really hard now to transfer money around the globe. Just like, you know, back in the early 90s, it was really hard to send a letter to somebody in another country. Email came about, and then all of a sudden people could communicate really easily from the US to someone in South America to someone in Europe. And as that, you know, kind of reached a mass scale, we saw all those efficiencies that we've been living in for the past 15 plus years. You know, the same ideas, you know, the payment infrastructure for the U.S. and the payment infrastructure for the world, it's just not there yet. You know, the payment infrastructure in the U.S., you know, went digital through the ACH system in, a decades ago. It hasn't really gotten a revamp. And, you know, there's not really, one single global payment rail that everybody can hit if they want to make a payment of some sort. And people think that, you know, not Bitcoin as a speculative currency, but just Bitcoin as the blockchain and just registering kind of transactions, you know, or another blockchain-like system could be something that does that. And that would mean that if, you know, in the context of Ebola, if, you know, we heard that there was an awful thing that happened in another country, you know, we could easily make donations and send our money without lots of fees getting taken out in between. And that, you know, that could really be a wonderful thing. On the flip side, if you're in a country that doesn't currently have a great payment system, much like if you're in a country that, you know, doesn't have a great communication system, but now you have the internet, you'd be able to now, you know, utilize this global payment system to kind of enter into the rest of the world. And, you know, the potential for that is really astounding. You know, it would, you know, if everybody in the world could kind of use the same system and could kind of do business using the same, you know, the same pipe, then, you know, it's unimaginable what we can do. You know, we could easily send, you know, our products to rural Africa or, you know, or other places like that, which we just can't do now because we don't have the infrastructure in place.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say, you know, this is something that you know, people are getting excited about. You know, the Federal Reserve is fully aware that their payment system needs to be updated. They have a big initiative about this, and you know, other banking officials that, you know, I've spoken to some. I know other people have as well. Are really looking at this technology. You know, at least exploring it to see if it's something that could be used to kind of help bring us, you know, up to date and make sure that, you know, that we can start doing these things.
Right. And we've been talking a lot on this show over the years about machine-assisted contracts, streamlining the contracting process. We've touched on it a bit in the show today, you know, with artists and creators and, you know, if you want to easily grant a license or, you know, maybe there's a micropayment involved, maybe there's not. But taking it beyond that to the more general world of contracting, we've been talking about smart contracts a bit on the show, and I want to get a little deeper into that here and have you guys explain to me and our listeners and viewers why the blockchain really puts that on a fast track. Why don't we start with Peter?
Okay, so we've been talking about it in the abstract, and I suppose mm-hmm. getting more into the weeds is helpful, although it starts to get difficult to explain. What I like to say is just fundamentally speaking, what cryptographic currencies enable us to do with blockchains is, as I said, provably show that something that existed on somebody's, you know, in somebody's particular address, they're called a public address, that to which only they have the private key to access the things in that address, has moved to someone else's public address. And now only they have the key to that thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's the basis of value transfer. And what's actually happening is there's this little, you know, phrase that gets sent out to all the computers on the Bitcoin network or the Bitcoin protocol. And that phrase says, you know, Peter transfers this much to Denise or to Aaron or to whatever. And those computers, some of them are called mining clients, and they're just software that some people choose to run. And the software then looks at what I just said. I wanted to send this to this, and they say, okay, I'm going to add that to my list of everyone's transactions that are happening right now. And they add that to this list, and they solve this difficult math problem that was set up by the last person to mine and to describe all the transactions. And that happened, you know, somewhere between, you know, 1 and 10 minutes ago, that last person described all the transactions. And they set up this math problem. And now this new person is doing the same thing, along with all the other people in the network, trying to describe all the transactions in the 10 minutes. Solve the difficult math problem in order to write the next block in this ledger of all the transactions that are happening. And the first person to do it, you know, and it's very difficult to predict who will be the first person to do it, because solving that math problem is so difficult that if one computer was working on it by itself, it could run for, you know, thousands to, you know, millions of years. But if many, many, many hundreds of thousands or millions of people are working on solving the problem, then we know with some statistical certainty that within about 10 minutes, one person, we don't know who, will stumble upon the answer. and they will then write the actual ledger. Now, what they're actually writing down, as I said, is normally this little simple sentence that says, Peter sent to Denise this many coins. But that's not all Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous inventor of Bitcoin, allowed for you to actually say. You can say a more complex sentence. So it's not just Peter sends to Denise this many coins. It's Peter has these coins in this public address and has one key to this public address. And Aaron has this other key, and they turn the keys simultaneously. And only when they turn the both of their keys do the funds actually move to the next person, to Denise. And so you can build these sentences of how you want value to move through. And the sentence can be as simple as one person to one person. It can be more complicated, two people to one person if the two people agree. Or it can involve variables like time, like two people agree and this time has happened. So the mm-hmm. Bitcoin network can keep track of time and can say, oh, at this date in the future, this should go through. And finally, you can also, in theory, invoke external variables out in the world. These are called oracles sometimes. So it would be the contract's going to go and query a price from, say, the New York Stock Exchange ticker and say, when the price of this hits this, then the transaction should go through. So you get to start to see, you know, all of the elements, many of the elements of common law contracting here. If this contingent fact realizes, then this result should happen. If this doesn't, then this result should happen. And you can set that up all ex ante so that it will happen deterministically through the math. Now, you can't necessarily write a complete contract with all of the squishy human variables that we find important, like the particular nature of a warranty or when a product is broken or not broken and therefore you deserve a refund. But a lot of the in-betweens as far as how to go and get the refund can be effectuated automatically. Say you had somebody who was appointed as an arbitrator to say, yes, that product was broken, actually. They turn their key, and that's what actually makes the refund happen automatically. And you could pick that person automatically.
Wow, that is so fascinating. And I mean, just the from your description, the most obvious thing that comes to mind is a real estate transaction. And what you're describing is the escrow process, where people put things into a trusted third-party account for holding purposes until a bunch of conditions are satisfied, and then the transaction closes. And it sounds like if blockchain technology gets involved in a lot of contracts, the escrow people are going to be looking around for something else to do.
They'll just have better tools in order to do their job. So right now they've got filing cabinets full of people's things that they have to that we have to trust them to keep good order of. But there's probably still someone who's a real person looking out and saying, the transaction went south. The transaction did go south. And so that person's still going to need to exist. We're still going to need to know whether they bought the money pit and the floor, the house, the Victorian house actually had no floor. And that's going to be a real person still. And they're just going to have a better tool in order to do that. It's just like letter writing didn't stop happening when we got email. It just got easier. And someone who writes letters or does talk shows for a living now can do it at their home as opposed to doing it at a big, inefficient corporation.
So tell us exactly why, Peter, is your parents' deed in the blockchain?
I actually did that for Warren will appreciate this. I did that in order to just show that slide at the Legal Hackers meetup here in D.C., which if you're in D.C., you should show up at. They do great stuff. But I wanted to, I talked about how my parents recently bought this house out in the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Because I was a dork who was still at NYU Law at the time taking a property class, I wanted to say, oh, well, how do we know that we owned it? You know, and if you've taken property law, you know that there's a grantor-grantee index. And the amazing thing about a grantee-grantor index in the context of this discussion is that it looks like the blockchain. It's just the blockchain with really old, you know, documents that say bequeaths to, you know, Van Valkenburg from Bub. I think that's what it was. That's actually the final link in the blockchain of this property registry is from someone named Bub to my parents. And the fun thing is, if you leave that slide up, you can see in the upper right-hand corner of the deed on the left, there's some text there. And it's too small to read, but it's actually all the money that had to be paid in order to make this thing get saved in a Talbot County clerk registry. And it's $5,000. It's not a huge fee. It's $5,000 as compared to the value of the house, which was somewhere around $250,000 or $300,000, I think. Not to air my family's finances on the internet, but I just did. And so the tricky thing, the really tricky thing about the grantor-grantee index and the reason why it exists is you'll have people who show up and say, actually, I have this deed. I've always had this deed to this house. And you got a deed from someone. I don't know who you got it from. He gave it to me before he gave it to you. And that's the double spending problem in computer science, actually. That's the exact same thing that Bitcoin was built to solve, was to create this provable record that, no, actually, you can't spend that Bitcoin twice at two retailers. You spent it once, and now we know you don't have it anymore. And so it's kind of fun, and it's a fun way to explain Bitcoin to lawyers, I think, who actually are, geek out about grantor-grantee indexes, is that you could do all this with a blockchain, and you could do it lightning fast and without the $5,000 title fee, a much lower fee, the fee you pay as a retainer to your family lawyer who knows how to use technology.
Yeah. So we're going to make Dad's Deed the second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law.
They're joint.
Mom and Dad's Deed. Yeah, I will take either Dad's Deed or Dad and Mom's Deed. People are already, I just keep coming back to, if the blockchain becomes the transaction registry for everything, then doesn't that take a technology that thrives and is exciting because of its decentralization and make it a centralized resource for a whole lot of data?
Well, it's not going to be one blockchain. I think most people are assuming that there's going to be multiple blockchains. So, right now, just like we have different databases that we use, but they're just locked behind a company. So if we want to use eBay, we have to go to ebay.com, and enter into a transaction with another person who's also registered for eBay. And then all that information is stored in eBay's database. In the future, you could just have a shared blockchain that nobody really owns that facilitates all the same transactions that eBay is doing. So the only person that's really taken out, or person, I guess under the law, person who's taken out of the equation is eBay Inc. Now you just have a shared resource and it's kind of facilitating the same type of transactions that have happened. And people are already building this. You can go and look up a project online called Open Bazaar. And this is what they're building, a completely decentralized eBay. This messaging systems is the same thing. Right now, we go to Google and if we use Gmail and we send a message, they record in a database and then, someone else accesses that record in the database. You could have a messaging blockchain, which just facilitates that same transaction without the need for it to have to pass through, without the need to have it pass through Google's servers. It could just be on multiple different servers all around the internet. Dropbox, Uber, all of these companies are middlemen, and they're all running databases. And I think over time, we're just going to see a lot of these middlemen either run decentralized databases and just kind of be the managers of that, or their business models are just going to get tightened, to a point where it might not be feasible for them to really operate anymore.
And I'm not too apocalyptic as far as predicting the intermediaries disappearing. I mean, this is all, as I said, we're still talking about, it's like we're talking about the internet in 1994. But my mm-hmm. Half-baked prediction is actually we still keep intermediaries. And as we were just talking about, they'll have a decentralized database. But they still serve a purpose. And that purpose is going to be creating the user interface or the user experience to actually access the decentralized database. And that's a very important thing, because right now, when we talk about these things, These things can, to some extent, be done by typing very long strings of characters into a computer terminal that interacts with the Bitcoin client, that interacts with the Bitcoin network. And you have to, you know, these are all things that my grandmother is frightened by because she thinks her computer's watching her in the middle of the night. It's true. And she won't see this because she doesn't use computers. So it's, well, you know, but how do we get my grandmother to trust something like this? And it's going to be a really good user interface. And that's something that robots don't do well, but people still do well. So Uber, you know, might decide they're still going to connect drivers with people who want to be driven. But they'll be able to negotiate, you know, with each other in a decentralized marketplace for all the cars in the area. But Uber's still got a very important job. They've got this job of building the smartphone app that interacts with that decentralized database, making it look good, making people feel comfortable with it, and maintaining it, and even marketing and advertising. I mean, those are very important things as well. Half of our economy must be persuasion, I get the feeling. And that's not really a waste. That's people talking about what they care about and what they should do.
You know, I hear people talk a lot about Bitcoin and blockchain-related technologies as being a solution to security and surveillance and everything else. And maybe you can expand a bit on that, because what I'm hearing from our discussion today and my understanding coming into it is that when we've got a registry of that it all relies on having a very public registry of information that is transparent and verifiable. And part of the way that people rely, you know, for good or bad, on privacy today is these very silos of information where their data lives, and the fact that it's not public and transparent, and that once, you know, not only the people facilitating the transactions have access, but really anyone has access to information stored on a blockchain, don't they? And so does this just create okay, well, enlighten me then, because I'm envisioning it's this whole world of data mining enterprises that are all based on looking at transactions on the blockchain, no?
So here's the trick, and this is what was really clever about it. It's that everything on the blockchain is wrapped in public-private key cryptography. So you have a public-facing event that everybody can knows occurred, but the substance of what that event is, nobody knows. So, for example, here's an example for in terms of privacy and how when people are talking about how the blockchain could be used for to enhance privacy, this is how it would look like. Let's say that there was just an identity blockchain. This was a blockchain that stored all of your personal information that you usually input into websites. So it has your name, your last name, your address, your credit card numbers, maybe multiple credit card numbers, maybe additional people who are authorized to use your credit cards or other information. And that's all stored on a blockchain of some sort. And everybody's information is stored there, but nobody can look at each other's information. So I can't peer in and see what your information is because it's encrypted. I don't have the private key to unlock that lockbox to figure out that information, and I don't know what Peter's information is either. And you extrapolate that out for millions and millions of people. And
if you do have the key, that's when you can look at Peter's parents' deed.
But the real value that this technology can really pass along to companies is if there is an identity blockchain, then they wouldn't really have to worry as much about security. The way a website could work, let's say you're logging into the eBay of the future, this decentralized eBay, they could just say, identity blockchain, is this a human being? And the blockchain could just send back a ping that says yes. Or, identity blockchain, I need the credit card information for this person. Can you just give me that? And then the blockchain could send it back just the credit card information without all this other data. And they would never need to store this data. So, hackers would have a much harder time, going around and finding all these vulnerabilities on various different sites. And that could save companies a lot of money. I mean, when JP Morgan lost the 70+ million, user account information, that's a serious problem for them. Just in terms of sending out, notices to them, is going to be very expensive. I'm sure if they had a solution like this and it was actually built, and this is a solution that isn't built, but people are talking about, I think that's something they'd at least be interested in integrating in some way. So that's really kind of how, privacy could look using kind of a distributed technology like this.
Peter, we've already splashed your parents' property information all over the internet, as you mentioned. But can anyone who else, anyone else who's interested in getting that kind of information, can they go to the blockchain and get it, or is it cryptographically shielded from them?
So what I actually did, and so like a real decentralized grantor grantee index doesn't yet exist. It would be something that you'd hope either a law services corporation in a given area would start to help build and maintain and give people, you know, help people access, or it would be something that a local government maybe chose to adopt as their way of securely and authoritatively describing the sequence of deeds and records and who owns what when. What I used is something much more primitive, again, internet circa 1995. It's called Proof of Existence. I think it's proofofexistence.com, but if it's not there, just Google Proof of Existence. And that service is much simpler. All that service does is you take a document, and what it'll do is it'll look at that document, the bits that are in that document, and it'll create a unique cryptographic hash, which is sort of like just a unique scramble of that document. And it'll put that hash, which is just, it's a way of saying there's no way to get this number by guessing unless you have the input. And so if you then have the deed as an input and you hold it up against the hash, which is on the blockchain, you can say that's that hash. And so you provably say that the only way that hash ever got into the blockchain at the time that it says it was in the blockchain was because the document existed. If the document hadn't existed, if you'd uploaded a different document, the hash would have been different. So because the hash looks the way it does, and because it was in the blockchain 2 years ago, this deed existed 2 years ago. So actually right now, it could be used by a lawyer. If somebody else came up and said, oh, that deed says Bub to Van Valkenburg 2 years ago, I have a deed that says Bub to Van Valkenburg 1 year ago, and you'd say, well, I mean, I set it up a little bit wrong. So if the deed doesn't say anything, you know, just imagine this deed that didn't have a date. It's a really lousy deed. And if there's someone else who comes up and says, I have a deed and it doesn't have a date either, at least we would know, because we can see it on the blockchain, that my parents' deed must have existed in order to create that unique cryptographic hash 2 years ago. And then we could say, okay, because we know that yours is 2 years old, this one that doesn't even have a date, we're just going to ignore it. And this is what a judge does when we're talking about transferring property. They look at all the indicia of when something existed or when something didn't, and they look at the statute for the local jurisdiction, which is either a race statute or a race notice statute, like the first person to get to the county courthouse or the first person to actually know that somebody else had previously purchased it. And, you know, the judge then has to make a choice. So right now, it's only useful so much as a way of proving that a document existed at a certain time. Although that has implications for, say, like the rules of evidence, of hearsay and these sorts of things. So, you know, these tools are already becoming useful. They'll be much more useful when we would actually have a blockchain that, as Aaron said, would be a dedicated blockchain, possibly. Or maybe it'd be a way of interacting with the Bitcoin blockchain that is purpose-built to actually create authoritative records. And then the judge would, all the judge would need to do is say, in this jurisdiction, we recognize this decentralized blockchain as the way of authoritatively declaring ownership. And this makes the judge's job very easy, because he can just look at it and say, you know, this happened and this happened.
Okay. We're already talking about some privacy-related issues moving from our policy discussion around Bitcoin into the privacy and security aspects of the technology. We have one other privacy-related story we're going to cover before we get out of here. So let's play the bumper, shall we? Warren, this is a good opportunity to consider how the Europeans might relate to some of the issues we've been discussing here today, and to more specifically hone in on the right to be forgotten and how it's impacting Google as they, and others, but Google specifically gets in the news a lot, as it tries to comply with that law. Can you bring us up to speed a bit?
Sure. So Google actually released a a report, I think it was today, very recently at least, just sort of detailing basic facts and figures on its right to be forgotten requests under EU data protection law. There's a recent high court ruling in the EU. Basically, the EU Supreme Court said, as many of your listeners are probably aware, that a person has the right effectively to be able to tell a search engine or similar websites to stop linking to particular content, to effectively get rid of that record where there is a sufficient balance in favor of the privacy rights of the individual versus the free speech right of actually sort of having that, having that content up there. So what Google's had to do as a result is sort of implement basically something like a DMCA takedown system for these right to be forgotten requests. And so they've released some data just now sort of detailing some of those things. I think they got something like just under 145,000 different requests from people who are making, personal data requests, requesting that, as based on their rights under EU law, Google has to pull down basically links that come up when you Google so-and-so's name in combination with certain other search terms that might pull up something that's embarrassing and no longer viewed as relevant under EU law. And so I'd link to that article. I thought it was pretty interesting also to compare that with an article that Jeffrey Toobin had written for The New Yorker that sort of broke down the disparity between U.S. law and EU law in this area, because obviously in the U.S. we have the First Amendment. It would make it really, really difficult to sort of implement a regime like this. And I love that title, "The Solace of Oblivion," too, which is somewhat dark, but it's a very good read. It's also very interesting. It starts with the story of this tragic incident, this father who lost his daughter. And then actually the photographs of, of the death scene wound up leaking on the internet, and he, feels that he has really no control over those photographs. And the argument is sort of contrasting with the EU, where theoretically at least, and this isn't actually even necessarily true under EU law, but, he might have the right to be able to go to Google and say, I don't own the copyright in these photographs. So I can't take them down under the copyright law, but if I have if there's a personal data protection right, then I can tell this search engine or this intermediary to stop linking to them, or I can ask them to get rid of the particular content just because it is relevant and effectively offensive to these privacy rights. So I mean, it's just an interesting story from my perspective. It's clearly sort of different regulatory regimes interacting with the technology of the web in sort of creating these effectively legal fiefdoms where you have different regulations and different abilities as a citizen in one state versus a citizen in another. So I just found that one to be a pretty interesting story, and I think it's going to be important as we keep going forward and under these regimes.
Well, now that I've got blockchain on the brain, I'm wondering if there's any way that blockchain technology can help Google out in it trying to comply with these requests. But I suppose that would require Google to somehow put on the blockchain every single web page that it has indexed and that it continues to index on an ongoing basis. Maybe that's not practical, or maybe it is. Who knows? Anybody want to take a stab at that, Aaron?
I think that's conceivable. I think that you'll start to see blockchain technology used in search. I really do. I think that it's a good database. So maybe Google would start to do that.
Martha Stewart would approve. It's a good database.
Yeah. maybe you could also transact with people in order to get records taken down. It'd probably be hugely expensive to unilaterally negotiate with every person who has a record of something you don't want up there. But I don't know.
Well, One thing you might want to think about too is, you know, in term for Google, they've got to basically verify in some way that it would be ideal. I think they just do it now based on a certification. But basically, you've got to verify that this person has the rights to claim that content being taken down. Maybe there's a Bitcoin element right there. This person is who they say they are.
It all makes me so nervous because, as you said, so privacy is just the ultimate and heterogeneous good. It's everyone has a different definition of what they have should be private or not private or public, and the negotiations for that are difficult from a I'm going to pay you to take stuff down level, and they're very difficult from a I'm going to use government policy to take stuff down, because as you said, we get all these legal fiefdoms. I'm sure we'll see people try these things with blockchains because, as we've discussed, they're very powerful. But I can't imagine an implementation that would achieve anything like a universal ability to take down all versions of a thing. These machines just really weren't built for that. And I think they're fighting history when they try and really aggressively enforce something like a right to be forgotten.
Yeah, excellent point. All right, well, we're going to get out of here, but not before we give you our tip and resource of the week. Our tip of the week this week is real simple. It's hack the law. If you are listening to this show, it's because you're either a lawyer or a technologist or someone who is interested in technology, who is also interested in the intersection of those two areas, law and technology, and how they can battle with each other sometimes and need help to negotiate those waters. So get involved if you are one of those people. If you're looking for more information about legal hacking, there's a really nice article by Ed Sohn at Above the Law called How to Hack the Law According to Morpheus. And the title refers to the fact that Ed Sohn asked Phil Weiss, the founder of Legal Hackers, one of the founders of Legal Hackers, if he was a character in The Matrix, if Legal Hackers were a character in The Matrix, who would they be? And he said, oh, Morpheus, you know, no doubt. So that sort of sets things up nicely. And there are already formalized legal hacker groups in, as we were talking about, New York and D.C., also Los Angeles. NC, that's North Carolina, Warren?
Yep,
and also Stockholm. So obviously there's a lot of the world that still needs to get the memo on this. And if you are someone in one of those non-represented areas, then this is a great opportunity for you to get involved. So always look at how we can make law and policy work more nicely together. And Warren, you guys are doing a great job of that.
Thank you. And definitely there's a lot of other groups out there too. You know, there's a lot of interest in law and technology right now. It's very cool. There's just like so much sort of there's a groundswell of just general interest in people who want to, like you say, hack the law and find ways to make it work in ways that haven't really been typical or possible beforehand.
That's absolutely true. And we try and do it, as you mentioned, here every week. Our resource for you this week is given to us by Peter. It's an article called What Smart Contracts Need to Learn. It's at Lawbitrage. Peter, can you tell us a bit about this and why it's a great resource?
Yeah. So that's from Hooman Shadab, who's at New York Law School. I think it's a very sharp and reasonable take on smart contracts. You'll find some people out there who are true evangelists who are saying, you know, we're gonna do everything on the blockchain. It's gonna be amazing. You know, the singularity is near, etc. and Hooman's tone is very, careful, neutral, considering the technology. He lays it out in some detail for you to see, and then he also goes through what he thinks are some of the limitations, especially that sort of squishy human element. That no matter what, we're always going to be contracting between two people. So you can't just have, you know, robots determining everything. You're going to need lawyers to be negotiators. And that's just this has great synergy with Warren and Legal Hack, and what Aaron's doing with his clinic at Cardozo. I know is we really need to be pairing young lawyers, and not like the kind of lawyers that are out here in D.C. I mean, some of them, but not the ones that are like marching up to Capitol Hill every day. The ones that are in the local county courthouse, or you know, just trying to make contracts between people and to make property deals happen. Those nuts and bolts lawyers that are down in the boiler room of the ship shoveling coal, those are the ones that are going to really benefit from this technology. And if our society can organize itself better and more cheaply by giving those people the technological tools to do their job more authoritatively and better, it's going to be really, it's going to be a wild ride.
Right. And consumers are going to, learn to code and definitely, you know, make yourself heard if you're a consumer and not a lawyer or a coder, because goodness knows anybody who's been involved in, you know, a car transaction or real estate transaction knows that our contracting process as it exists today is not exactly state of the art. And it's a big old pain. So we do need to make things work securely and well. And we may have some of the secure down now, but the well and streamlined part definitely has a ways to go. So make your voice heard on that front. And thanks, Peter, for the pointer to that. And thank you all so much for joining me today on This Week in Law. It's been a really fascinating show. I've learned a bunch. I've got, you know, even more I want to go research and learn more about. So Warren Allen, thank you so much for joining us again. It's great to have you back on the show.
It's awesome to be back, Denise. Thank you so much for having me. It's really cool every time.
It's wonderful to have you. And are there any, I know we just had a DC legal hackers meetup, and then there was something about, I forget, it had code in the name. What was the name of
code
the event
deal,
you just
had?
Code the Deal. Exactly. About so Phil, smart contracts, right?
Well, it was really just transactional law in general. So there, you know, we had got a bunch of people, you know, again, in a room, you know, had a legal hackathon where, you know, we wound up with 16 different projects that actually presented. And, you know, we gave some great cash prizes actually to three really amazing projects. And really everything that we wound up seeing submitted was very cool and made us think. But, you know, the winner wound up being a program called Redline, where they were really designed a prototype for effectively a better way of doing the whole redlining a contract process that we all know and love so much, but doing it in a simpler way where you have, you know, live sort of collaboration. You can, you know, you can screen out comments so that you can communicate internally on one side and your opposition can communicate on the other side. So it was a very cool project. You know, again, Phil Weiss, who is the founder of Legal Hackers, and, you know, I'm one of the organizers and he is too, but we both were there from the beginning pretty much, but he deserves the credit for, you know, coming up with the idea in the first place. And he was really lead on this too, working with Nixon Peabody, the law firm, and Aaron Yoel there. They put this event together and, you know, we helped give a lot of support, but it was really a very impressive event that wound up happening there. Oh, and then I should also mention, we've got an upcoming event, October 23rd, at CT in New York, and that's going to be a legal tech demo night. So more lots of legal tech happening in the city.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Warren, and keep up the great work. Aaron, thank you so much for lighting the fire under me to do this show today. I'm so glad that we've gotten into these topics. There's obviously much more to unpack, but at least we've touched on them.
Yeah, and the only thing I wanted to thank you very much. I really wanted to thank you for having me and everybody else and bringing attention to this important topic. You know, we've also at Cardozo, we're bringing Superintendent Losky, the you know, of the Department of Financial Services, to the school, and he's going to be talking about the BIT license, and we're going to be talking about this more. You know, I can post a link, and we're live streaming it, so anybody in New York or anywhere else can kind of view it. We have a great all-star panel that's going to follow up his talk to just kind of continue this discussion.
That's great. And should people go to the Tech Startup Clinic to look for that link when you do live stream it?
I'll post it in IRC and maybe to Delicious too.
Yeah. Just as long as you put it in IRC, I'll pick it up from there and we'll make sure it gets into our discussion points for the show. And Peter, it's been really thrilling to meet you. Tell us a bit about Coin Center. I know it's just founded last month, correct? You and Jerry?
Correct. Yeah.
And others?
We're pretty fresh faced, and We're joining a couple other people who are in the space here in DC, like the Bitcoin Foundation. We're not associated with them, but there's certainly so much work to be done that we're happy to be a resource for educators. I mean, an educator for policymakers and a resource for policymakers. We've got a long, long and hopefully prosperous road of law and cryptocurrency ahead of us that we're just going to hope to uncover. And as I said before, the internet in 95 is a good metaphor. So hopefully we can, you know, hopefully we can help the community repeat some of the successes of internet policy and maybe avoid some of the pitfalls when it comes to cryptocurrencies.
Good for you. It's definitely a necessary role. So thanks so much for doing it and for joining us today. I've been thrilled to chat with all of you, thrilled that all of you listening and viewing could join us as well. You can catch this show every Friday. It starts in the morning Pacific time, 11 o'clock Pacific, 1800 UTC. So, you know, late morning, early afternoon, depending on where you are in the U.S. or if you are international, we're thrilled to have you joining us too. If you missed the show live or you can't make it live every week, that doesn't matter. We have all our shows out there on demand for you in various venues. Twit.tv/Twill is our main page. You can find us on YouTube. We're This Week in Law there. We're in iTunes and on the Roku and wherever else you like to pick up this sort of programming. We're there for you. And also we're there on the social networks as well. Great way to get in touch between the shows. I'm D Howell on Twitter. The show has a Facebook page and also a Google Plus page. If you have a little bit more to say, those are good places to do it. Also, you can email me. I'm Denise@twit.tv. Great way to get in touch. Let us know if you've thought of other applications for the blockchain as a result of listening to the show. Let us know what other topics that you think are just right in our sweet spot that we may have just blown by up to this point, because I love hearing about that and fixing it and continuing to monitor things that are important as they unfold. So let us know what's on your radar and we'll put it on ours. What else should I tell you? I think that's about it. We've done a great show today. We hope you've enjoyed it. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.